Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the education channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Tom DeSena, from the Department of Communication, Journalism, and Public Relations at Oakland University. My guest today is Christopher R. Martin, the author of No Longer Newsworthy, How the Mainstream Media Abandoned the Working Class, from ILR Press, an imprint of Cornell University Press. In No Longer Newsworthy, Martin chronicles the deteriorating fortunes of the U.S. working class through a close examination of how it is represented in mainstream news. Chris Martin is a professor of digital journalism in the Department of Communication and Media at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls, Iowa. He is the winner of the 2020 CLR James Award from the Working Class Studies Association and a Choice Outstanding Academic Title for 2019. He is also the author of an award-winning book on how labor unions are covered in the news media, framed Labor and the Corporate Media. Martin is a contributing scholar to the Center for Journalism and Liberty and a regular contributor to the Working Class Perspectives blog. Chris Martin, welcome to the New Books Network.
Oh, thank you very much, Tom. It's nice to be here.
You begin the book in 2016 with the election of Donald Trump and the sort of bewildered and consternated reaction of many in the mainstream media over the Trump voter. But especially in the first chapter, you look at Trump's performance at the Carrier plant in Indiana. Can you tell our listeners why this moment illustrated so much that has gone wrong in how mainstream media covers labor issues?
Well, it was interesting. It was something that happened actually before Trump actually became president. He had been elected, and it was in that interim period between election and inauguration. There was a Carrier plant in the Indianapolis area that was going out of business. They were moving the jobs south of the border to Mexico. And Trump had, when he was on the campaign trail in 2000, actually people had complained about it. And he said, yeah, something should be done about that. But he really didn't take it seriously. And then there was actually a news package on NBC after he was elected talking about this. And it was workers from that same plant complaining about, nothing was being done about it. So Trump decided to, with his vice president-elect Mike Pence, who was the, at that time, still the governor of Indiana, he hadn't resigned yet, went to Indianapolis and said they were going to save jobs. So they went in and they had a big announcement, a big media event, and the media, the mainstream media congratulated them and hailed them as you know, this is a guy who's getting things done. As it turned out later, and the head of the union of those workers in Indianapolis at the Carrier plant revealed only about half of those jobs were saved. And so Trump responded by insulting the guy on Twitter, like he has been apt to do. Mm-hmm. And it ended up, being something where I think the mainstream media really missed the mark. They didn't look closely at it. They were kind of willing to celebrate the president without looking closely that this was not a very good deal. And in fact, it was a deal that was made with millions of dollars for Carrier and incentives. And it's ironically a deal that Mike Pence had not made as governor of Indiana. He pretty much told the workers, sorry, can't help you. And then decides, you know, with pressure as the new vice president-elect to try to make something work. It was interesting because in the coverage, there was no coverage about the union and what they had done and tried to do for months and months to keep that plant alive, because actually it wasn't losing money. It was a profit-bearing plant, but they just thought they could make more money in Mexico. And it was also interesting because it was ultimately a political story. So the workers that were interviewed in the media later on who were praising Trump were white, mostly male workers. And that, you know, that was kind of shorthand for these are Trump people. What's interesting about that plant is that it's about 50% black in terms of the workers, and also about 50% women. And those voices were just kind of missing because they didn't fit this narrative that Trump is really the savior of the white working class.
And also, it doesn't really fit with how the media has been representing the working class more generally. And I want to return to that idea in the last chapter of your book, where we talk about the teacher strikes, or what another guest on my show has called the teacher insurgency. Mm-hmm. So let's go to give a little bit of history about how we've come to this. You offer a history about how labor has been reported in U.S. newspapers, especially, and then how that has shifted over the years. Can you give our listeners a little sense of what that process has looked like?
Yeah, it was something that was very interesting to me, and it kind of came to me one day in an archive in Cleveland, and I was looking at the archives of a former Cleveland Plain Dealer labor reporter. And what was interesting in the late 50s and early 60s, as I looked at his articles, there would be things like transportation strikes, and he would write about, you know, the ongoing negotiations between labor and the administration, trying to figure out what exactly what the deal was going to be in the new labor contract. And what was missing in those stories, and was kind of surprising and kind of refreshing in a way, there weren't a lot of stories about the people who were affected by the strike. The treatment of the stories was, there's a strike on, in this case, is a transit strike. Some people are not going to be able to get to work. They're going to have to walk. They're going to have to hitch rides. They're going to have to find another way to get there. But it was taken as, this is kind of a normal thing. You know, people will strike. We're all in support of it in a way. I mean, they didn't say it that exactly, but it was kind of like, you know, this is what we do as citizens. You know, we have to work around the strike ourselves. But that's just kind of an everyday thing of life. So that was kind of a common way that strikes in particular were handled through the 50s and 60s. And by the late 60s and early 70s, and this kind of fits in as newspapers start to become publicly traded, bigger conglomerates, we start to see a different way that these stories are treated. And we start to see the rise of people and stories about inconvenienced upscale consumers. I actually, my other book that you mentioned, Framed Labor in the Corporate Media, I talk about the 90s, and this is, you know, all through the 90s and even 80s before that, this is a common thing. In fact, if you saw, you know, an airline strike, you'd probably, you know, one of the first things you would see in a TV story is they're interviewing people who were going to be on a flight and couldn't get it because these darn workers are striking. So we start to see the rise of that narrative, which hadn't been there before, in the late 60s and in the early 70s, carried through to today even. You know, it's a kind of story that focuses more on people as consumers rather than as citizens. And it's an interesting way. I don't think there was a top-down edict saying, like, you know, all news stories are going to be this way, but it made sense in the corporatization of news. And these news organizations were actually having labor problems themselves. And it made sense in the political winds of the 70s and into the 80s for sure.
Yeah, and your chapter on how newspapers began to market themselves really sort of clarifies a lot of that story. Can you talk a little bit about that chapter, the way that I guess this gets to the subtitle, right? The sort of the moment when newspapers began to abandon the working class and focus on upscale consumers.
Absolutely. So I was seeing it in the articles about strikes and things like that, as I'd mentioned. But I wanted it's kind of a mystery to unravel. I wanted to say, is there evidence that they actually did change who they were thinking of as their target consumers? Because when you're at a news organization, I mean, there's a common understanding about who you're writing for and who you're reporting for. And if it's not all citizens, but it's a certain group of citizens, that changes. You just kind of absorb that in the organizational principles of the place where you're working. You kind of, that's who you do your news for. So I was looking at Editor and Publisher, which has been around for more than 100 years as a magazine, and especially in the 20th century, it was really the Bible of the newspaper industry. And so if you were a newspaper or a newspaper group and wanted to, get national advertisers advertising in your paper or papers, you would put an ad in Editor and Publisher and say, we're the Cleveland Plain Dealer in Cleveland, or we're the Detroit Free Press, the Detroit News, right. And this is the kind of audience we have. And what you started to see as we go from the 50s and 60s into the 70s and 80s is that all of the newspapers across the country start talking about not how you can just get everyone who lives in the Metro Detroit area, but you can get more upscale readers. And they actually start saying, like, our readers are, greater than average in terms of, household income, in terms of education, and all those other markers of being an upscale type of consumer. So it's really interesting. They actually switched who they were focusing on, and the media stopped, focusing on, and by the media, I mean newspapers, but we see it in other media as well, focusing on just the place that they're serving, the metro area or the state or the country, and instead going for upscale consumers, because that was in especially in the late 60s and early 70s, what business was starting to focus on. Those are the people, the demographics we really need to reach. So it's not the general public, but it's this very specific slice of the public. And in doing so, that comes back, as you mentioned, to the subtitle, How the Mainstream Media Abandoned the Working Class. And that's really what happened there.
And it's also curious that, of course, this coincides, not coincidentally, with the beginning of a very dramatic fall off in newspaper readership.
There really was. It was interesting. People with a high school education or less were some of the biggest group of readers of newspapers. And that, if you start not paying attention to them, those are the people who just kind of slide off in readership, and you're going for increasingly, maybe a more lucrative market, but it's a much smaller market to go for upscale consumers. The other thing that happened that kind of reinforces this in the 70s, we start to see the decline of the labor beat and the rise of more workplace lifestyle columns, which is more about, like, it's more for office workers. So it's, there are things like how to handle office romances, what to wear on casual Friday and things like that, how to get along with your boss and not, it doesn't really address you as a worker. The other thing that happens, and we see this, as well, the rise of personal finance news. So things that we kind of take for granted, like Money Magazine and the big business sections in newspapers and on television, business news channels, that all happened starting in the 70s. So it's this idea that we all have pots of money to invest, that we're the future millionaires if we are just smart enough to pay attention to how to invest our money wisely. And again, that's for a segment of America that can afford that. Most people, aren't playing the stock market.
At least not directly, right? I mean, again, that's so it's, right. The workplace is still being covered, right? There are still people who are thinking about the workplace, and there are still people who are thinking about it, but the vantage point is no longer that of the worker.
Yeah, and you really see that fall off, all around the country. I mean, there were a number of labor reporters. There was kind of the height of it in the 1950s. The New York Times, for example, for a couple decades there had, typically at least four reporters on the labor beat. And by the end of the 1980s, it was down to one, and it's just still there. And if you talk to them, they would say, well, we have other people, step in on labor news from time to time on this angle and that angle. But, it's you wouldn't do that to sports, right? I mean, they wouldn't say, on the NFL beat, we're just going to have one person and, we'll have some other people come in and report on that. And you're going to notice you're not going to get the best news about the NFL if that's not what they usually cover. So then that's kind of how labor is treated in the United States.
And anymore, if you want to cover the NFL, you have to be a labor reporter as well.
I mean, that's right.
Just trying to wrap my head around the vicissitudes salary caps and various other collective bargaining issues is just mind-boggling when I listen to it on the radio.
Absolutely. And it's actually sometimes those, you know, sports labor issues aren't covered well because they don't have a labor journalist on them. They have like a sports right. person on them. So it's not going to get covered very well. I mean, I would always argue for more labor people because, you know, it affects, you know, we have more than 160 million people in America that work. I mean, we have a lot of things to cover. And you know, the newspaper record in the New York Times has one labor reporter. You know, there's really no one in any of the networks that actually do that. There's one person now back again at NPR, but that, you know, it's such a big, enormous sure. beat and just not enough people.
Yeah. So this leads, of course, to the different ways or the different narratives that start to emerge about workers. And you focus especially here on transit strikes again, but I think it's worth revisiting some of those ideas.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the comparisons I do looks at a transit strike 40 years in between, one from the 40s and one from the 80s in New York. And again, in the 40s, it was really about the workers and what kind of negotiations are happening. What are the major issues? And, you know, hundreds, actually, there were hundreds of thousands of people that were displaced.
Sure.
And then we cut to one in the 1980s and where we had, about 900,000 people, commuters displaced 40 years earlier. By the 1980s, it's about 90,000 displaced. So just 1/10 of that. But that becomes the major lead of the story about how commuters were really cut loose and couldn't be and couldn't get to their place. And, you know, in New York Times, there was an interesting photo of three kind of rumpled executives, upper middle class business executives in their trench coats. And they're in a really kind of crummy looking, graffiti covered subway. And which is not the regular way they go to work. And so it was like they were lost and confused and, we're to have pity on them. And that they have to, endure a little bit of discomfort there, but we don't measure that against what's the discomfort of the workers who are on strike, who, are obviously striking because there is something not going well financially in their lives or not going well in terms of the work rules. So it's really fascinating to look at these differences from one time to the next and how the stories change so much.
And this is, of course, also where you start to fill in some of the gaps about how conservative media start to take up some of these issues of the abandoned working class.
Yeah, it's interesting. So we mentioned that the working class were abandoned by the mainstream press as they went towards a more upper middle class audience. So working class readers really didn't have anyone kind of appealing to them or kind of calling out to them. Conservative media, which was just kind of growing in the 1970s, saw an opportunity. And while they didn't go for all of America's working class, they started trying to appeal to America's white working class. And so we start to see it a little bit with, Rupert Murdoch, the Australian, buying the New York Post. Later, he gets American citizenship so he can, buy a lot more.
Yeah.
In the 70s, also the Christian Broadcasting Network, which wasn't just about religion, but it was really a political movement, and they were interested in the white working class. Rush Limbaugh on deregulated radio in the 1980s, Fox News with Rupert Murdoch again in the 1990s, and then, as you start to see internet sites like the Drudge Report and Breitbart and a number of others from the 90s into today. And these are all really appealing to, the aggrieved an abandoned white working class. So it's really about appealing to them and their grievances, which I think helps to set the stage for the politics we've seen in the last decade or so.
Although it's not, again, it's appealing to their grievances, but not necessarily to their identities as workers or as part of labor, right?
No, you're absolutely right. It's not about that. In fact, I mean, I think you would be shocked to turn on Fox News them talking to white working class people saying, we need to raise your minimum wage, or you should have health care. It's not those things. Instead, we see the culture wars. So it's appealing to them, you know, in terms of religious ideas. It's appealing to them in terms of, you know, being anti-immigration. You know, it's appealing to them in terms of, you know, the supposed war on Christmas, like all these things that are supposed to be, you know, that are kind of rocking their world culturally. You know, these are the bad things that that the left, including, you know, labor unions, is bringing to you. So they really try to drive a big wedge, you know, and this politically, this happens as early as Nixon in the late 60s and early 70s, trying to drive a wedge between the left and the working class. So and we see that, you know, really work well for the Republican Party in terms of trying to, you know, be talking about cultural issues and not economic issues.
Right. Because, and really at this point, no one is really talking to workers as workers. And here you start to identify even some of the ways that in presidential rhetoric, the idea of the working class begins to disappear.
That's right. I mean, if you go back and look at, you know, things that Eisenhower said as kind of a moderate Republican, you know, in the 1950s, I mean, they sound, you know, almost Marxist in comparison to things today. you know, there is this kind of stepping back and kind of nervousness about associating yourself with the working class and using terms like the working class. So we start to see, you know, over from the 60s into the 70s and 80s and 90s, this moderating, not using the terms class, but using terms, and you'll hear it even today, things like working families.
Right.
Which is trying to, you know, do a little turn on that. Like, we're talking about people who work, but we're also appealing to this kind of conservative notion about families. So it's working families instead of the working class, and try to make class invisible, because, you know, the Republican Party, and even to some extent, the Democratic Party, is not doing a very good job on that through the 80s and into the 90s. They're kind of scared of taking that kind of position.
Yeah, so it's curious. I mean, I assume it's part of the same kind of political drift that we see in the news. But, you know, and as you said, the Democrats are in a lot of ways really no better at this than the Republicans. But what do you suspect it accounts for, that abandonment of addressing people as workers? That's a tough question. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, I think it is a tough one, but I think it actually fits in with this idea that especially was popular in the 1980s under Reagan, that labor unions were bad things, that they were kind of the source of our problems. It wasn't capitalism. It wasn't like the export of capital. It wasn't about the race to the bottom in terms of wages. You know, all things that were happening, you know, in a big way in the 1980s, including, you know, less taxes on the very wealthy, but it was blaming the labor unions for being greedy. And you know, the important moment that's mentioned in the book and by many others is Reagan's firing of the striking air traffic controllers, the PATCO workers, and that just really, you know, in an instant, just changed the attitude towards labor. And far fewer strikes happened, you know, in the decades after that, because people were scared that you would just fire the workers and bring in replacement workers, which is what Reagan did. So it really, there was all this blaming on labor unions, and indeed, you know, labor unions weren't perfect in the 60s and 70s, and they had grown kind of fat and greedy, and some of them were corrupt. But, you know, you could easily say the same thing for businesses.
Absolutely.
In the 60s and 70s and 80s.
And 90s, you know, 2000, 2020.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing us up to date on that. That's important.
Yeah.
So there's a big clampdown. You know, at the same time, we don't have that clampdown on business, but we have a huge clampdown on labor, and, you know, some labor unions, you know, going into receivership and being run, you know, run by government appointed people. And, you know, so there's really not a lot of freedom to labor unions, and not a lot of freedom to organize anymore. It had been made difficult, you know, back in the 50s. And as businesses had started to change and decentralize, it's become much more difficult to try to organize people. So, you know, we can even look at where we are right now. I mean, there is kind of a resurgence in labor labor energy, and you talked about the teacher insurgency, but it's really difficult to do right now. It's much more difficult to organize these days.
Oh, sure.
Than it was, several decades ago, and starting with especially Reagan in the 80s.
Yeah, and it's interesting. This isn't in your book, but just having grown up in Metro Detroit, and of course, the home front, if you will, of a kind of labor aristocracy around workers with the UAW. Mm-hmm. There was this kind of white collar resentment, I would describe, against people who were living these, who had a place in the North Country and who had more than one car and who had all of these sort of, markers of an upper middle class life, but, who had only, gone to high school and got a job at a factory.
Mm-hmm. I think there was a sense the take on labor, had shifted from how do I join and how do I get that lifestyle to, these people are greedy and taking money away from me. So it actually made the situation bad for all workers rather than bringing up workers who, into that kind of middle-class lifestyle. It ended up, having them be angry at people who had achieved that.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, so that, we see a huge, divide starting in the 80s between, the upper classes and the working class. And we're still living that life right now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So from presidential rhetoric, you go to Google and track how the idea of class is framed in sort of a wider frame, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting. There are one of the things I was looking at, again, to try to fill out, this whole history, is to figure out Google has something called the N-gram, and people can try that, just the letter N and with the word gram, G-R-A-M. And it tracks the use of certain terms in books, in millions of books for the entire 20th century and a little bit into the 21st. And what you start to see is the shift of some of the language is the way we talk about things. For example, the workplace starts to actually, we start to talk less about corporations and more about the workplace, which actually kind of gets away from thinking about who's actually running the workplaces. We start to see the rise of certain terms like entrepreneur and Wall Street in books, and especially that is from the 1980s onward, and the decline of terms like working class. We start to see the decline of terms like citizen, the rise of terms like consumer, the decline of worker and the rise of employee. So all of those things start to suggest that we're becoming much less class sensitive, much more sensitive and interested in terms like being team players and employees rather than being workers, investing in Wall Street, being an entrepreneur, and all that fits in with how the media really push that as well, with the workplace lifestyle columns, with personal finance news, and the decline of the labor beat. So it actually, you see it, that's the same things reflected in books as illustrated by Google's database.
And one of the terms, and you spend a chapter on this, that starts to rise to prominence is job killer. And I wonder if you could walk our listeners through a little bit about how this phrase came into being and what effect it seems to have.
Yeah, it's been very effective. It's a term that was not used through most of the 20th century, and then we start to see a little bit of it in the 1980s. But it becomes a really big, important term, really is deployed by Republicans and Newt Gingrich, who is the head of the House Republicans through part of the 90s, in arguing at first against Bill Clinton when he was a new president. And the idea was that is that the worst thing you could do as a politician is to kill jobs, right? I mean, that was the idea, at least. And what Democrats like Bill Clinton were doing were maybe supporting labor unions, and labor unions are job killers. Maybe supporting business regulations; those are job killers. Later on, anything that would be trying to alleviate climate change. Those are job killers. So any kind of regulation or labor union that would get in the way, that would be seen as anti-business, is a job killer. And it's very effective, and it was most effective in the media. I mean, you certainly have the conservative media doing that unproblematically, but you see the mainstream media using this in unproblematic ways as well. So rarely, when the term job killer was deployed by a politician, was it called into question, or was it fact checked at all? You know, if you're charging that someone's killing jobs, what exactly you're talking about? What kind of jobs? How many jobs? And so they got to kind of use that with impunity. So was it deployed in a big way towards Clinton in the 90s, and then in even, you know, many times that amount in Obama's administration, starting in 2008 through 2016. So anytime he tried to make a move, something was called a job killer. And what's interesting about that, I think the press is starting to be a little bit more critical about that, because the idea, and I think it's because of COVID, and this idea of essential jobs and people, some people not going back to jobs. Yeah. It's like not every job is great. So right. When you're saying you're a job killer, what jobs are you talking about? And actually, who wants a $725 an hour job these days, right? I mean, that doesn't offer any benefits. So for Republicans, it's always been any job is a good job. And for I think a lot of Americans now, I think they're saying, like, wait a minute, if I'm going to be, you know, in danger, like, not any job is a good job. I mean, I'm going to do this. I want to get, you know, paid this amount, a living wage. I want these kind of benefits, et cetera. So that's been an interesting history, but it's been a very powerful term, you know, until just recently.
Although, again, I guess in thinking about that issue and, you know, what seems to be a kind of refusal of bad jobs on the part of American workers is still being framed largely as the inconvenience that it causes to consumers.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's still that frame. You're right. So people are having bad experiences at restaurants because there's not enough wait staff or less people. The workers are to blame for that, you know, and it's been clearly illustrated by at least some business owners that they don't have a problem with employment if you pay workers enough and make those jobs not just any jobs, but jobs that are worth decent jobs for someone to have. Like, any job that's worth having should be a decent job. And so I think some Americans are coming around to that, and, you know, and realizing that we've had, you know, the recovery from the recession, you know, of 2007, 2008, and that didn't go terribly well for Americans, although it went really well for wealthy people. And then this whole period of, you know, of COVID and essential work is like, you know, some of us can work from home, you know, via Zoom and other things. But there's people who have to be, you know, in harm's way. And if they're not getting paid well, you know, on one hand, we're kind of bowing down to them and acknowledge them as essential workers. But, you know, we need to put our money where our mouth is.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about that, because in the final chapter of your book, you identify a number of ways that we should rethink the news about U.S. workers. So you begin this with sort of thinking about the term job killers in a new way.
Yeah, I think one thing we might want to think about, and I've been kind of encouraging people, I just had some, you know, simple ways to think about that, but that it actually might be corporations who are job killers. And I was trying to calculate, you know, how many jobs might be there if big corporations, at least the ones that we know about and have records of, you know, hadn't offshored, you know, trillions of dollars. And if we brought that money back, if we hadn't made that, you know, hidden that money from taxes and taxed it at the rates that it should be taxed, you know, we could, that would be enough to create, you know, in excess of 20 million jobs, you know, that are paid at least $15 an hour. I just kind of use that as a standard, since that was kind of the standard, you know, argument for what would be a decent job. I realize even in a number of places, that's still not even sufficient.
Of course.
But the idea is that the job killers aren't labor unions. The labor unions have actually been the institution that have given us decent jobs historically in America. And where there aren't labor unions is oftentimes where we get the jobs that aren't so good. And the people who are killing those jobs are the capitalist class that's hoarding money and actually not investing that back in workers, but instead, you know, hiding it from taxes and offshoring it. And, you know, that's money that should be in our economy. That's money that people worked for. I mean, they didn't make it all by themselves. There were a lot of people that did that labor that made, you know, people like Jeff Bezos rich, for example, or made, you know, the owners of Apple Computer rich. And we have these enormous trillion-dollar valuation companies. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, a number of people working for them that aren't making very much money. And that's certainly a problem.
Yeah. And that also leads us to one of the other things you identify, which is the issue of excess compensation.
Yeah. I mean, thanks for mentioning that. You know, back in the 50s and 60s, I mean, it was maybe 30 to 60 times a regular worker's wage is what the CEO would make. And now we're to the point, you know, where it's, 250 to 300 times what an average worker would make at that same company. And sometimes even much more than that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, how much compensation is enough compensation? So you have executives sitting on compensation boards and awarding that the kind of compensation they would like to other executives. And it just becomes this, you know, this very small group of people awarding more and more money to them. And it also, a lot of the money is taxed at a low rate because it's stock options. And so they don't even pay, you know, the taxes. I think, we've had some executives talk about it, that their secretaries might pay a higher tax rate than they earn.
Yeah. I think, what's his name? Buffett talks about that.
Yeah, that's right. Warren Buffett. So that's, you know, those kind of things are a problem. And really speak to the inequality, and that inequality, you know, at some point it comes around to kind of bite you on the rear end. And we're seeing that, you know, with teachers, and we're seeing that with other workers right now. I mean, the passion is certainly there. The ability to organize is difficult at the same time, because we've not really seen an updating in labor law, although there's certainly a good one that's out there right now, the PRO Act. That's put forward.
Well, we are seeing some updating. I mean, within the last few years, Michigan has become a right to work state. So that's an update.
That's not a good update.
No.
You know, you're thinking, what would be? Yeah. So you know, that kind of continues. I mean, we've seen more and more right to work states. I'm in one in Iowa too, and it's not a great experience. And we saw a similar thing happened here that happened in Wisconsin, where there was a huge crackdown on the ability of public workers to be able to collectively bargain. So that just happened to us just a few years ago in Iowa. So it's not a great experience, and starts the slow march to impoverishing public workers. Right? They're just not their level of compensation is going to slowly decline, and I'm already seeing it happening at our university compared to peer institutions.
Sure. And that kind of leads also to the issue of taxation, which you address in the conclusion as well.
That's right. The right has been, pushing for, increasingly flat taxes, which wouldn't be, the people who make the most pay the most. The tax enforcement has been so lax that it just allows for so many people to go, unaudited and unpunished when they're actually flouting the tax laws in the United States. So if we actually taxed, the wealthy the way they should be taxed, and actually there's talk of this in D.C. right now, and Congress doesn't all seem to be on the same page about it, but it would actually really increase our revenues enormously. So it's not a matter we need to lower taxes, and the whole myth of, lower taxes increases prosperity is just not proven, to be the case over several decades that we've lived through now.
Oh yeah. I mean, there are a number of them. I'm interviewing someone on a book about income inequality later this semester. And, we can clearly see that as society, as the taxation becomes less progressive, we get these kind of inequalities and all of the problems that they start to create for the entire country.
Absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about the teacher insurgency. I think that's kind of where you end your book, and sort of the changing shape or image of the working class.
Yeah, you know, it's really impressive, the teacher strike, and I like the fact that you used insurgency, because it happened mostly in states that were, you know, as we divide everything to red and blue, but it happened in, you know, more conservative states. And I think teachers, and people oftentimes, I like teachers because they kind of defy, you know, this idea of who the working class is. Yeah. It's usually like a white hard hat, which is kind of like the stereotype, you know, and there are members of the working class that fit that. But one of the biggest groups are public employees, and one of the biggest groups of public employees are teachers, who are predominantly women, and predominantly well-educated too. I mean, you have to be a teacher. And so, and yet, among all people of that education level, they are the lowest paid people with those kinds of degrees. It's really wonderful that they kind of, because the media wasn't really covering the situation of teachers, the teachers actually going out and protesting, and I've talked about this in other books, that gets the attention of the press, and sometimes you need to do that, and it's really important and effective to actually, when you feel like you've been ignored by the media, when you feel like you've been ignored by politicians, to actually go out literally into the streets and protest gets people's attention. And so that's been impressive and a good thing for the labor movement. The other good thing is that a number of media organizations themselves, as actually people who have not been treated well in the economy in the past couple decades, a number of employees have organized in places that you would never think would be organized, like the Los Angeles Times or the Chicago Right. Tribune, which were both owned by, you know, families that were very anti-labor for decades. To see those, you know, as they've gone through a number of different ownership models and owners, for those people to organize has been very impressive. So we've seen that in large and small newspapers, digital news organizations as well, a lot of people organizing. And I think that people who write the news, you know, are certainly going to be a little bit more sensitive to what the situation is.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the teachers are important as well, because the framing of that story was just a little bit different. If you talk about a strike that had the potential to be disruptive to people's private lives, you know, a teacher strike is pretty serious. If all of a sudden, you know, I mean, we all just faced this with the pandemic, when your kids have no place to go to school, it kind of throws your entire schedule for a complete loop. And yet, with those, with most of those strikes, you had support in the community for the teachers.
Yeah. What's interesting about this, and strikes tend to be more effective in these instances when the public knows the people who are on strike. I was, years ago, as in the late 90s, there was a UPS strike, and that was effective too, because people know who their UPS delivery person is. If you get packages, you get to know that person. Same way with teachers. I mean, you know, and you probably know this person even better. You spend time, and your kids spend time with these teachers. They're members of your community. You care about these people. They're caring for your kids and teaching your kids. And so you have a lot more empathy towards workers that you know and like. And in this case, while it is disruptive, I think the teachers made a really good case for a saying that I like, is that teachers' working conditions are students' learning conditions. And I think they really made that come clear. I mean, and when you started to see the media, especially the national media, look at the horrible classroom situations and then realize this thing that happens all the time, that teachers spend hundreds of dollars themselves to buy school supplies every year for things that, you know, that we, the taxpayer, should be paying for. I mean, you start to realize these people are saints and they've sacrificed a lot, and we deserve to pay them better.
Yeah, absolutely. So the other part to the conclusion talks about the democratic role of journalism, or the function of journalism in a democratic society. So I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's really important for the news media to kind of rethink what happened in the late 60s and early 70s when they started to focus more on an upscale audience. So when you focus just on a very limited demographic, you lose sight of the fact that the news media's focus should be on all citizens. And that is its very democratic purpose, that it's supposed to be a check on government, but also something that if there is a bias in the media, it's a bias that should be in favor of citizens. It should be in favor of democracy. And to lose focus of that and just see yourself as purely a business is to really miss out on what the purpose of journalism is. So as news organizations, and I think as there's been upheaval in news organizations as well, we talked about, you know, there's more news workers joining labor unions, but as the whole model for financing journalism has changed and is being challenged, we're seeing more nonprofit journalism. And that's getting back to this idea that we don't have to make boatloads of money like newspapers did for many, many, many decades. But instead, we should, you know, think about what's the best way to bring news to people and to all people, not just a group of upscale consumers. Because honestly, you know, appealing to upscale consumers isn't going to cut it for newspapers these days. So they have to rethink how they can appeal to a larger group of people. And part of that, I would argue, is, you know, going back and making sure you're talking to everyone, you know, all the classes of people, not just the upscale readers.
Yeah, although, again, you know, one of the problems is with the word citizen in general. And I think journalists and maybe even the rest of us have a hard time conceptualizing anymore what a citizen is apart from a consumer.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing to wrap your head around, I think, because we've oftentimes made those kind of equal things, citizens and consumers, and there's a big difference there. We have to be able to, you know, as journalists, think about everyone, you know, not just based on, you know, how much they can buy or what they can buy, but the fact that we should all be equal citizens, you know, in the eyes of journalism and under the law too, for that matter. And it's something that we constantly need to remind ourselves that that's the purpose of journalism.
Yeah. Well, Chris Martin, I want to thank you for this book. As I think I mentioned to you when we were setting up the interview, I had the opportunity to assign it to a graduate class, and it went over very well. And I'd like to ask, what can we expect from you next?
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to talk, Tom. And I'm not sure yet. I'm kind of looking at things. I've been in touch with some colleagues in Australia, and I'm thinking about doing some more comparative work about media and labor in the working class with the United States and Australia and maybe some other countries. So that I think that might be kind of an interesting take on it.
Well, that sounds exciting. Would you get the chance to travel to Australia?
I don't know. That might be in there. Maybe I'll just be zooming for the rest of my life.
let's hope it doesn't come to that. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Christopher Martin. Once again, he is the author of No Longer Newsworthy, How the Mainstream Media Abandoned the Working Class, from ILR Press, an imprint of Cornell University, Cornell University Press. And this has been the Education Channel of the New Books Network, and I'm Tom DeSena. Thank you very much for tuning in.